Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, the opioid crisis, the drug epidemic we're facing in Alaska and around the country, affects almost every area of our lives, from crime to health to government services. It's really an extraordinary issue that has got to be addressed, and a lot of people are trying. Today, we're going to be meeting a couple of grassroots activists, folks touched by this crisis, who have responded by trying to help others and to try to get through it. And we're also going to be talking to a state expert who is managing this from the point of view of a state public health emergency. And so that's all coming up this hour, and we're going to be looking for your questions as well and comments about the issue of the opioid crisis. In a few minutes, you're going to be meeting Mark Weaver and Kim Whitaker, who are our grassroots activists who are doing so much on this and are very inspiring folks to me. But right now, I want to invite Andy Jones with us for a few minutes to kind of get the overview from the state level. He's the director of the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention with the state of Alaska. Thanks for being with us, Andy.
Thanks, Charles.
So this has been declared an emergency, and just sort of to get our hands around what that means exactly, why was it declared an emergency, and what are the indicators that tell us how bad this problem is?
Yeah, that's a great question. So thank you for that question. And I'm going to start real quick back in 2016. And in 2016, the Alaska legislature passed a bill called Senate Bill 23. And this bill was actually designed to do a few really important things that have driven us to declaring a disaster. One, it was designed to allow healthcare providers to directly dispense the life-saving overdose drug, naloxone. And a lot of people say, well, healthcare providers can dispense, but they added two critical areas. Pharmacists could dispense and community health aides, which means you didn't have to have a prescription anymore. You could walk right to a pharmacy. But when you look at that model, the bad things to it is you have to have money. You've got to have insurance. And when you're in active addiction, a lot of times people are going to choose the substance maybe over the naloxone, or people who are in hardship can't afford something that's $150. Now, the other piece of Senate Bill 23 that was really important, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase this, but it said a volunteer or an employee of an overdose response program that receives training can dispense and administer the same life-saving drug. So as we moved along in 2016, we received a $5 million grant for 5 years to do three things: educate the community on prescription on overdose deaths, equip the community with the training they need to reverse those overdose deaths, and then equip them with the kits. So we started going down this route, building a program, working with individuals like Kim and Mark, you know, and making sure we built a program that was, it was from the ground up, something that wasn't designed to put so much burden onto an organization that they wouldn't do it. Because our end goal was to save another Alaskan's life.
So right. And just on that point of like saving lives, how many lives are being lost? What is the scale of this in terms of numbers?
Yeah, no, that's great. So in 2016, we lost about 120. There was about 129 drug overdose deaths. Of those deaths, about 96 of them were linked to opioids. In 2017, between 2017 and 18, we had 100 overdose deaths related to opioids. Now, Charles, when you look at those numbers, you know, and you look at our closest partner, Vancouver, British Columbia, for example, we had a prescription opioid problem. Now, we're squeezing that balloon on that prescription opioid problem by, you know, instilling prescribing guidelines, mandatory reporting with the prescription drug monitoring program, and a whole bunch of other things. But when you squeeze that balloon, a lot of times what happens is then another substance like heroin comes to the market. So we have a heroin problem. And then this last year, we've seen this influx of a really powerful synthetic drug called fentanyl. And so we never like to use the metric of how many that reduction in overdose deaths, because as fentanyl has emerged into our community, it's so powerful. We're seeing, you know, our fear is we may see more of these deaths.
Wow. So we haven't really turned a corner. I mean, do you feel like obviously the naloxone and the sort of rescuing people as they're overdosing is a very, very necessary way to save lives, but that's not a solution. How do we turn the corner on this thing and try to bring down the number of people who are addicted?
No, that's a great question. So one of the things we did is when we declared that disaster, Valentine's Day of 2017, we did it, Charles, for two things. We did it because we didn't have the medical authority to write a statewide medical order. And so one of the things that allowed us to do is when we declared that disaster, Dr. Butler could write a statewide medical order. So then individuals like Fallen Up Ministries or, you know, Real About Addiction, they don't have that medical oversight. So now they can be agents of change in our community to provide those Narcan kits. So I think we're turning a corner, Charles, if we don't look just at deaths, but we look at things like educating. Educating our community has been powerful. Partnering with our peer recovery services and our grassroots efforts have been powerful. Community coalition gathering meetings. I'm in Juneau today because we're hosting a community cafe series talking about opioids. We're really changing the tide when it comes to stigma. Stigma with you, stigma with treatment. And you have to almost start at that bottom level because this solution is not something that the government's going to cure. The community is going to cure it. And so we're seeing, I know I say cure, I would say, you know, make a
address.
Big stride
yeah.
effort. Address.
Well, let me ask you this. We often hear about treatment not being adequate or not enough treatment available. Has the amount of treatment for the sort of long-term treatment to get folks detoxified and then get them into a new life, is that increased in availability, and is it adequate?
No, that's a great question, Charles. So you're right. When we talk to community members, we always hear we need more detox, we need more treatment, and they're definitely right. We are working to expand that. A lot of it, that expansion comes through federal grants. But we're also building a public-private partnership because federal grants come and go. So we don't want to put money into a community, a service is there, and then it just shuts down once that grant goes away. We're doing it. Are we doing it adequately, or is it enough treatment? No, definitely is not. We could use more. But here's the other piece we have to look at, Charles, and this is where I think the grassroots efforts is so essential. Treatment only lasts so long, right? I mean, and in treatment, there's a lot of time where you're not working with a provider, and those grassroots peers are the ones who are the guardian angels walking the individual through a complex continuum of care. And so they're making sure they don't fall through the cracks. The other piece that we have to really work hard on is building the back end of it. Like I said, is recovery is a lifelong thing. You have to work to reengage with your community. So sober living, housing, and environments are essential because once you're done with treatment, like I said, you got to get a job. You got to build your friend base back up, your professional base back up. And those, I mean, that's essential. So that's where I see the peers really are part of the entire continuum of care.
Right, and that's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour is the grassroots. And I was amazed to find out that these folks were out there and they were doing as much as they are. You must have a lot of contact with them. And just give me your personal impression of seeing these grassroots folks and what they do.
You know, I'm going to first start out by every time, because this is a topic that can be very dark sometimes. And I love talking to people like Mark and Kim because they always feel that hope. There's hope there. So, but here's the beautiful thing. They have the lived experience. So I always say, like, a vet will talk to a veteran. A peer will talk to a peer. They have that connection that we, Charles, may not have, right? And so the value is essential there. When you look at Alaska's model, we're not always going to be able to fit to what the lower 48 is doing, and we have to think outside the box. You know, if we can't expand treatment like the rest of the country maybe, how do we do it for Alaska? You know, how do we make this effective and essential? And I think that's where the peers come in. You know, if Anchorage finds somebody, police department who wants to seek treatment, yet there's no beds available, is that officer going to spend his time trying to find a bed? Does that make sense? Or is it the peer who's going to find that bed, get that individual signed up for Medicaid? And that's where we've seen this value based. The other thing, Charles, real quick, I'll have to tell you is they're the ones who are educating me and my staff about what's going on in the field. Yes, we're out there, but they are the boots on the ground. So we use them as subject matter experts as much as they're willing. And it's amazing how willing they are to provide the information that we need and the support. So,
right. And as volunteers, as you mentioned, it is terrific. Well, thank you, Andy.
Yeah.
Andy Jones, he's the director of the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, joining us from Juneau. Thanks a lot for being on with us, Andy.
Thanks, Charles. You guys have a great day.
All right. And now you've heard a little bit about my guests on Hometown Alaska, who are these really remarkable folks that I have had the privilege of writing about in my column, The Anchorage Daily News. Kim Whitaker is the head of the Anchorage Opioid Task Force and of the nonprofit that she started, Real About Addiction. And Kim is also a home daycare provider. Expected to be in the studio with us today, but was unable to get coverage that would allow her to get away. So she was kind enough to join us by phone, but it just shows you like she's got a very full life. So thanks for being with us, Kim.
Thank you, Charles.
And in the studio is Mark Weaver, who is from the Valley. He's a vice president of Fallen Up Ministries, and also does the same kind of work with as a volunteer with folks on the front lines. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And we're going to welcome your calls. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Mark, you lived a long life dogged by addiction before you became somebody who was reaching out and being a leader in fighting addiction. And I've heard your story before, and it's really a powerful story, but it really started out when you were just a kid, right? And it was just getting out of that was a lifelong battle.
Yes, Charles. So, my journey, my addiction journey started with alcohol and ended with alcohol, and I had just a little bit of everything else in between. So I had to learn different lessons at different times in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't remember when I took my first drink, but I certainly remember when I took my last drink. So my first drink, I was in my single digits.
And, just a kid.
And my last drink was a little over 3 years and 4 months ago.
All right.
And so
you've been clean and sober and all that time. And sort of if one of the things that you had said was that the ability to get out of that life was partly because you learned a lot about recovery from different programs you've been
yes.
in. But also your faith.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did, the first time I went to rehab, I was 16 years old, and I learned a lot of tools that I carried with me through my journey and that. But what really took root in my life was people investing in my life that really didn't seem to have anything to gain from it other than just doing it out of love and just speaking truth into my life and faith. You know, my recovery is fully faith-based, so and I just live it and breathe it and share it.
Yeah. Well, that's so interesting what you say, like people who weren't looking for anything and they weren't making a salary, they were volunteers just like you, right?
Right.
I mean, and that must mean you when you're passing that on, you're sort of paying it forward to other folks who need the same.
Absolutely. It's fully just out of gratitude, and it's just when you discover it's like when you discover new music or just uh-huh. anything cool, you want to give it away. And so how much cooler is it to give somebody a second chance at life? You know, I mean, because so most of us that are involved in this are very touched deeply by it. It's very personal from us, and we have a lot of pain from the losses of our loved ones and a lot of the pain that we've been through ourselves. And so, yeah, when we find solutions, we love to give it away.
Yeah. And I guess it's probably also pretty hard for these people who are in active addiction to, like, put one over on you, right? Because you
right.
probably know every line
right.
of the book.
That's just it. I'm just very blessed to connect with those people that are reaching mm-hmm. out for the first time, because, you know, I didn't get my knowledge from a book, and so that never worked for me in the past. You know, I could sniff it right out within the first minute or two of talking to somebody if they lived it, or they were just, you know, quoting things that they
right.
learned from a book. And so, yeah, I can really connect in real ways with people from life experience, and I am hard to get one over on. You know, I can sniff it out like
yeah.
nobody else.
Yeah. Kim, your story is a bit different from Mark's, because you were never a drug user, but it happened in your family, right?
Yes. Well, when I was way younger, I had sampled in certain things, but nothing really took. I just didn't have that chemistry or personality for it to take, by the grace of God. But I have a daughter who is an active heroin addict, and I love her dearly. And in March of 2015, I decided to quit hiding that dark secret that I had been carrying for 15 years about her and go public with it. And she respects me, and things have changed for her and I's relationship due to this. She still is in active addiction, and we still live the nightmare I do of getting that call that she has overdosed, because she does do that quite often. I definitely keep her in Narcan kits one at a time, but Mark and I are both distributors of the Narcan kits for the naloxone that Andy was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I want to say real quick that I really appreciated what Andy had just said about that this isn't my daughter's addiction problem. It's not my family problem. It's a community problem. And we really do need the community to come together on this.
Yeah. So your daughter had this problem, and you felt that it was a shameful problem that you would not talk about until you saw something in the newspaper, right? And that really changed your life.
Right. In March, I saw an article about Jackie Smallwood and her daughter had passed away from an overdose. And Jackie felt it was very necessary to make it public because, like myself, you learn early. First of all, it's really hard to figure out what your child's on. I was falling for the I have anemia or I have fibromyalgia, so the doctor prescribed me opiates and Xanax, and they're trying to work out the right medication level that I need. I would fall for all of these excuses, and finally, it was just overwhelmingly obvious that she was a heroin addict.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause she had stepped up from when she lost her insurance. She had stepped up from the prescription pills to heroin in order to not be sick. She suffers from trauma as a child. She suffers from undiagnosed mental illnesses. She was given prescriptions. That's a combination for a storm.
Yeah.
Those three are the three main causes. And 4 out of 5 heroin addicts started with prescription pills. And the reason why some of it takes to some people and it doesn't others is genetics and it's trauma from the past that they're getting over and they're self-medicating.
Yeah. I was just going to say that you could have just focused on your own family, but you've now, like Mark, you've turned outward and you're focusing. You may not be able to save your daughter right now, but you're saving a lot of other people.
And that's what gives me hope. That's honestly not the motivation behind it. It's about saving lives, and it's about humanizing precious people that are precious people on this earth that deserve to be loved. Tough love does not work. Boundaries do. I'm not saying people should allow somebody in active addiction into their home, but I'm saying don't cut them off if they don't have a connection with another human being. So that's what Mark and I are. We are sometimes the first person that says to them, we appreciate you, we want to help you because you're worth it. They've been pushed away from society and family, jobs, anything that they could have ever hoped to have in their life, they no longer have except their dope. So when somebody makes a connection with them and tells them that they are worth it, it really, you just see them tear up. The family is just astounded that when you tell them, don't out your child. You've got to love them through this.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks, Kim. So that's Kim Whitaker. She's the founder of Real About Addiction, which she fits into her regular life, amazingly enough. Mark Weaver is with Fallen Up Ministries. He's also here. And my name is Charles Wolforth. The show is Hometown Alaska. And I'm going to give out the phone number if you want to get on the show with us in a minute. But right now I want to introduce Laura, who's calling from the Valley. Laura?
Hey, how are you guys? This is a really timely show, and I'm just kind of sitting, I'm having a long driveway moment here, listening in my car. And I think that opioid addiction is sneaky, and I think it was Kim who said, you know, her daughter made up all of these excuses, and in the end it was just BS, and she knew it was an addiction. But the thing is that you just don't know the signs. And so I was thinking something that would be really great that could be put out, you know, for parents in the Valley, in Alaska, for anybody who has fears that they have an opioid addict in their family, is a list of what it looks like. And I know it couldn't be all-encompassing, but it could be, you know, sleeps 20 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It could be nods off. It could be has seizures. It could be, I mean, there's so many signs. And I know kind of what I'm talking about. My son is an opioid addict in recovery. And it was really, really scary. And we ignored it for a long time because we were just lied to and manipulated terribly and told it wasn't what we thought it was. And, you know, in the end, we realized it was all just BS and that it really was an addiction. And we had totally missed the signs because we didn't know what they looked like.
Yeah. Mark, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. So, yeah, the real telltale signs are pinpoint pupils, you know, moist skin, you know, loss of color, the nodding, and you know, just all the odd hours, you know. So I mean, when you're inactive addiction, if you're not using like every 6 hours with the opioids, you're starting to get sick.
Wow. So it really chases you.
I wanted to say, first of all, I'm very grateful that your son is in long-term recovery. That is just amazing news. And that I wanted to tell you that Real About Addiction, which I also want to mention, Mark is on the board for Real About Addiction also. He's in a lot of things.
Right.
So we're very close. That's my brother.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we offer family support through Real About Addiction, 440-7289. And we talk to parents, and we have parents call us often, and they'll ask, what is this? I don't see any injection mark. Well, have you ever found a piece of foil with something burnt and black on it? And they'll almost always say yes. So then we've narrowed it down to they're smoking something. And the part of trying to figure it out, I have to add, is that there's a lot of denial that was going on in my part of thinking that this is just no way that my child crossed the line to heroin. You know, there's just no way. So there, you know, we have to talk to them and tell them to be alone in that situation of a parent of somebody with addiction is heart-wrenching. It just consumes you. So if you get active into a parent support group and you're able to discuss it, Mark and I have never had a parent support group that we leave and say, this was useless. Never. It's never happened. It's always very, very profound. And every group is different. We combine people in long-term recovery, family members of loved ones with addiction, and we have people coming in with active addiction, sometimes with their family member. And next thing we know, they're reaching out for recovery.
Yeah, that's great.
It's a good combination of the three, and we kind of aren't anonymous. We don't go and tell everybody's story outside the room, but we're very public about these meetings, and everyone is welcome. It's very inclusive, and it's so needed. It's such a huge part of the community coming together is for it, because if it's not in your home, it's in your neighbor's home.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, Kim, and we're going to come back in just a minute, and we'll have more discussion with my guests, Kim Whitaker and Mark Weaver, who are grassroots activists fighting the opioid addiction. And I'll give out those phone numbers if you have a question or comment to get on the air with us on Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. We're talking about grassroots response to the opioid epidemic with Kim Whitaker of Real About Addiction and Mark Weaver of Fallen Up Ministries. And we want to hear from you. I know a lot of our listeners have personal knowledge in contact with this terrible epidemic, or maybe you don't know and you're wondering and you have some questions. The number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And that website, alaskapublic.org, you can find today's show, and you'll find there links to the groups we're talking about. So if you want to get in touch with Real About Addiction or the Alaska Opioid Policy Task Force or Fallen Up Ministries, those links are there. So I have a question for both of my guests. I'll start with you, Mark. You throw out these phone numbers and you have your business card that you hand around to people all over the place. And if somebody calls that number, it's not like they're calling a hotline or in a telephone room. They're calling your cell phone, and you're so taking these calls basically around the clock.
Yeah.
And as a volunteer, just being ready to go out and help people, which number one is amazing. Number two, why is that necessary? Why do you need to be sort of on call like that?
Well, you know, these issues don't typically happen 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. I mean, when people are in crisis, most of the time it's in the middle of the night. And that's just part of the beauty of the network that we have, is that we're not limited to those, you know, bankers' hours. So, it's crucial to be able to take these calls at all hours of the night, because when people are ready, they're ready, and too many hiccups, too many delays, and they're back out, you know, trying to get well again.
So there'll be a moment when somebody says, I got to get over this,
yeah,
because something, like probably
done.
Something really
I'm
bad
sick
has
and
happened.
Tired of being mm-hmm. sick and tired.
And then what do you do with that person?
So we just spend a little time unpacking what they have going on in their life, and, you know, find out where they've been, where they are now, and where they want to end up, because there's a lot of different paths to recovery. And so I don't just, you know, prescribe what worked for me. It doesn't work for everybody. So you spend a little bit of time getting to know people's personal stories, and just from experience and from networking with the people that we do, we have a pretty good idea from that initial conversation about, hey, these are probably some directions you might think about going. And mm-hmm. and people really, the things that work best, in my opinion, is when people, you know, have choices and they're deciding, you know, instead of somebody saying, you need to do this and you need to do that, you know, just kind of throw some options out there and say, hey, how about this? This sounds like this might be good for you. And then mm-hmm. when people are actively engaged in their own treatment plan, it's a lot more successful.
Yeah, yeah. Kim, you're just a mom, basically, and you're working in your own business, but you have your phone number out there, too, and you're getting these calls like Mark. And I remember one of the things, the first time we talked, it's like, what do you do with these people? And you said, well, one of the first things you do is get them signed up for benefits, right? I mean, that seems like there's a lot of paperwork to be done to get out of addiction. And give me the step-by-step of what you do when one of these folks rings your phone.
We have to be on call 24 hours a day because that window is very small and brief sometimes. It is a long time coming, but it's a very brief window. And sometimes it's just because they're out of dope and they're sick and they're tired of being sick. And so they reach out. And if you wait too long, they're going to find some and be right back where they came from. So that's why it's important to connect with them immediately. The very first step is the connection. I have to say that's got to be the number one very first step, is answering the phone and speaking with somebody and giving them time and telling them that there are people out there that care about them. The second thing, obviously, is we need to find out where they're at insurance-wise so that we can see which program to try to offer to them. If they are under a certain age and can qualify under their parents' insurance, we see if their parents will consider putting them on their insurance. If they're not, I'd have to say 99% of the people who call us qualify for Medicaid. They don't have jobs. A lot of them are homeless. They couch surf or live outside. So we immediately need to get the Medicaid started. Assessments is something we have to get pretty quickly also, because if they choose to go into our one and only detox in town, Ernie Turner Center, they don't do assessments in-house, which is an obstacle that the Anchorage Opiate Task Force is working on trying to improve. Because once they get in there to detox, they're in there 7 to 10 days detoxing. And if they're let out on the 7th or 10th day and we haven't gotten them an assessment, and then they have them fill out the application that they've chosen. They have to have a TB test and a physical. Those three are pretty simple to get while they're there. They'll do that. But the assessment, if we don't get that, there's nobody in, nobody out of the facility, there we go. They're released to go back exactly where they came from.
So we've got to get them diverted into a new life and a new, you know, into long-term treatment and to away from mm-hmm. their way of life they're in.
Yes, because they'll go right back where they came from if we don't. And it seems to be pretty successful to most of them are choosing to do rehabilitation outside of where they are from for immediately. Not, you know, they could come back long term and do something where they came from, but it just seems to make it a lot easier on them if we put them on a plane, and we'd love to send them to Juneau to Rainforest for just a 28-day dual diagnosis, because there's a lot of mental illness attached to addiction. If they didn't already have some sort of something that needs treated mentally, they do after long-term addiction because of the way the brain has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So we address that to begin with. And then while they're there, we've got 28 days to find them long-term placement.
And there's more of a better glide path, yeah. Hey, let's go to a call from Angel, who is calling from Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Angel.
Okay. Yes.
And I just wanted to say that how important the community is. You know, a lot of the addicted personalities.
Are you still there?
And now the new monitor.
We got a bad connection. We lost you there for a minute. Let's try one more time. Yeah, I'm afraid that's not going to. Yeah, got a bad line there. So,
did he say email?
It was a call, but I think a bad cell phone connection. But in any event, the question or the comment was about sort of the community involvement and the community support being a really important part of this.
Mark? Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, oftentimes people say, hey, how can I help? And, you know, a couple good places to start. I mean, we've mentioned it already, the Anchorage Opioid Task Force, which the next one is April 12th. So that's always the second Thursday of every month at Anchor Park United Methodist Church, 2300 Oak Drive.
That's right there in Lake Otis, near DeBar.
From 4 to 6.
Yeah, from 4 to 6. So that's, you know, once a month, Anchorage Opioid Task Force
meetings.
That's
how I connected with these guys. Right. Just go in the church basement, and there's all these people telling their stories and talking about what they're doing.
That's one spot in Anchorage where we can network. And another one, a lot of this started in the Valley at the Mattsu Opioid Task Force, which meets the first Tuesday of every month at Wasilla High School now. And that the next one's coming up April 3rd, 4 to 6 p.m. at Wasilla High School Theater.
What kind of help are you guys looking for?
Well, that's the thing is, there's just so many places that we need help in this. But the obvious no-brainer is funding. You know, because we're all volunteers and you know, being part of part of Real About Addiction and part of Fallen Up Ministries, and so we would just like to be able to pay some people to do what the rest of us are doing on a volunteer level, because we can't, you know, we don't expect to tell people, hey, you need to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go down to the emergency department, you know.
Even though that's what you're doing.
That's what we're doing. Yeah. But you know, I can't volunteer somebody else for that.
Right. I think Angel's back. Do you want to give it another try?
Yes, I do.
Oh yeah, I can hear you better now.
Okay. I just wanted to say how important that your police officers, you know, seems how addicted people have so much contact with law enforcement, jails and hospitals, and oh boy, just a little compassion, you know, how far compassion goes. A lot of times you're looking for somebody to just say that I'm valid, that I count, you know, and to have these people show some kind of compassion, that they care. You know, I guess it humanizes the individual to allow them the opportunity to just breathe, to say, somebody actually cares about me, I count, you know, gives them the strength to maybe want to seek help, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. That sort of sounds like the truth. And there was an art project done here in Anchorage by the an art professor at UAA, Steve Gordon, and he included Kim Whitaker, who's my guest, and her daughter, who is was homeless at that time and an active addiction. And I really saw in your daughter, Kim, that just that amount of caring and attention seemed to have an impact with her. It made her realize that maybe she should make a change. And I don't know how that's worked out, but at the time, it seemed to the caring and the respect and the dignity of that particular event seemed to have an impact
with her. It was very profound. It was very heartwarming that a classroom full of people were getting to meet my beautiful daughter, who I love deeply, and seeing her for who she is and understanding that she is suffering from a disease And that's a big point that people need to understand is opiate addiction is a disease because it changes the brain. And people wouldn't out somebody dying from lung cancer because they smoked cigarettes or diabetes because they won't change their diet and exercise. But yet you see the stigma attached to heroin and opiates, and their body has to have it. So that's one of the first points is humanizing them, like the caller had just said. It gives them worth.
Yeah. You know, Mark, this is something that you were talking about the sort of the Christian love that you feel is an important part of what you do. And it strikes me that, like, an active addict could be a really hard person to love because they're doing a lot of lying. Yeah. They're probably doing a lot of stealing. They're doing a lot of bad things.
Yeah. So sometimes when I'm called, you know, when I go to an emergency department, when somebody thinks they're ready in that moment, and then you get there and, you know, maybe sometimes it'd take an hour to get there and things change that quick. And yeah, sometimes people are very difficult to deal with, and their family members, because they're desperate. And when they finally get somebody that shows up, they're frantic and they want it now. And that's, you know, we have obstacles that we need to get through. So yeah, it can be very difficult at times, and it makes you question your sanity at times. Like, hey man, you know, what am I getting myself into? But when you knock it out of the park, you know, when you see somebody that was right, you know, one foot in the grave, and you see somebody that changes their life and you know, getting reconnected with their families and becoming productive members of society and seeing that life back in their face, that is just, I mean, that's better than any drug I've ever done in my life, and I've done lots of them.
Yeah.
I'm smiling right now thinking about Client P.
Yeah.
I'm just, Mark, I worked with Client P, and it's just, it warms my heart every time I hear.
Once you saved a life, then you've really, it's really amazing. Yeah. Let's go to Rick. It sounds like he's got a fairly, fairly profound question here. Rick?
Yeah. Is there anybody speaking on behalf of those people that have chronic pain and that need medicine to survive? I'm not talking about people that abuse drugs. I'm talking about the people that have a lot of issues. For example, I have cancer and Parkinson's and Watson, and all I hear about how they're going to try to make it harder to get.
No.
But invariably happens, what starts this ball rolling of people getting into heroin is that they go, they're in pain management, and they run a couple days short someday, and they have to buy it off the streets, and perhaps they don't buy the exact pain medicine that they're prescribed. They go into the doctor, take a UA, and they get fired because they have something else that doesn't belong in their system. And then it's so difficult to get into pain management, and so here you have a person who is sick and has just been fired from his pain management and has a lot of chronic pain and issues, and so they're going to take the first thing that's available. And that's where I see, I've been in appearance for 30 years, most people I see go to heroin is driven by getting fired from pain management.
Yeah, I hear you, Rick. That's a real good point. Let me throw out to my guests here about that issue of how do we, I mean, some people need these drugs, right? Well, how do we keep
sir,
it?
That's absolutely. We deal with this often, because and that's the thing. We're not trying to take, pain management away from people that need it, because we've been touched on that end of it too. You know, I've had family members die of cancer. I didn't want my grandmother to suffer to her death, and so. And so, absolutely. That is part of the conversation. And that's some of the things that we problem solve with when people that need it do get fired from these programs. We help those people find other programs. And so, and again, we're not limited to 9 to 5. We work behind the scenes of saying, hey, this person really needs, you know, pain management. And so that's one area that we do actually help problem solve in. Absolutely.
Kim, do you have something to add to that?
I sympathize with you, sir, and I definitely do not want you to be in pain or anybody out there that has something wrong with them that needs pain management. We definitely do not want to interfere with that at all. We just want things to be watched over a little better due to the fact that a lot of people have gone to doctors and falsely gotten medications with trumped up illnesses, and they're overprescribed, and then So when Andy quoted the amount of people who had passed away from opiate overdoses, that doesn't include the whole, there's a whole group of people that have passed away due to opiates that's not in the statistics of overdose.
Yeah, yeah.
Car accidents, a mother rolling on their baby while they're sleeping because they're too drugged.
There's just infections so many, and
there's so many other aspects of it that torments families and lives. You know, it tears families apart. Kids are in OCS. But, sir, we definitely do not want you to go with pain.
All right. Well, thank you for those answers. We're going to take another quick break. When I come back, I'll reintroduce our guests and give you those phone numbers. We'll have another 20 minutes to talk about the opioid opioid epidemic here on Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guests today are Kim Whitaker of the Anchorage Opioid Task Force and Real About Addiction. She's a volunteer, a mom who helps people who are addicted, and Mark Weaver, who does the same kind of work in the Valley. He's with Fallen Up Ministries and Real About Addiction. And we welcome your calls, questions, comments. The number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. We've focused a lot on the individual help you guys are giving to people, but you've also been really involved in the public policy aspect of this. And Kim, you have had influence at the highest level in going to Washington, D.C., getting the attention of Senator Sullivan. He said that it was the most powerful meeting that he has ever attended as a senator, and probably influenced the way national legislation has come out of all of this thing. And that happened not that long after you kind of came out as a mom of an addict. And I just wonder, did you ever expect to be in this kind of role where you're having this kind of influence?
No, that had happened in, it was March that I had read that newspaper article and decided to make a change. And the way we got the group together was there were other people who had reached out to this mother, and that's how the group started. But it was October of 2015 that they had the great, humongous 30,000-some people rally on the mall in Washington, D.C. And Karen Nelson and that runs Haven House, a recovery program for women down in Juneau. I heard about her, never met her before, flew to Washington, D.C., met her there, and then a real good friend of ours, Terry Walters, went also. She's from the Valley, and then I'm from Anchorage, and there were six others that had gone. It was Kara and her, some of her people who live with her, so it was quite amazing. Got off the plane, went to a hotel. We all stayed in the same room. Some slept on the floor. We had just met for the first time. And we have an incredible bond to this day. This rally was incredible. I got the honors of being interviewed by Dr. Oz. There was amazing amount of great speakers. And going the next day to Murkowski's office, Don Young's office, and Senator Sullivan's. And Senator Sullivan was literally brought to tears because he had three daughters. And when he heard my story of my daughter, it really shook him to where he has made changes. So making changes on that level, somebody could have bet me $1 million the day before I opened up that newspaper and said, this is what you're going to be doing in October, and this is what you're going to be doing 4 years from now. I would have lost $1 million bet. But I do have a passion for this. I love it. I get a lot of joy out of it. I see hope. I'm optimistic about the future. And yes, we did have to have laws changed, We do have to work with the Anchorage Opiate Task Force. One of our big missions is working with the hospitals in town here to try to, like Mark Weaver out in the valley, he works with the Opiate Task Force out there, and they have gotten the hospital in the valley on board with their building a whole new addition for mental illness and drug addiction.
Yeah, so that's a big change.
Yeah, it's huge because still we have 14 beds for over 300,000 people for detox. Mm-hmm. That to this day is unacceptable. If we added 10 beds to each local hospital, that would be amazing. So that when our clients call us, we can pick them up and we can actually take them somewhere very quick.
Yeah. Mark, do you feel like, Kim mentioned the addition out of the Valley Hospital, or the Metsu Regional Hospital. Have other things happened? I mean, have we making progress?
Yeah, we're definitely making some progress, and we keep learning more and more every day. That's some of the things that we learned by showing up to task force meetings, is that there was actually more options than we knew about at the time, but a lot of these agencies weren't talking to each other, and that's the beauty of networking, is that now we share information on a regular basis. And are we where we want to be? No, not even close. But there's definitely some people that are stepping up to the plate, and there's new treatment facilities being built as we speak, expansions on two hospitals, and so we're definitely addressing the problem. But at the grassroots level, we're Alaskans. We're not waiting for people to build us shiny new buildings. You know, we work with what we have, and we're having some success doing that.
Yes, doing what you can. Yeah, let's go to Colleen, who's calling in from Anchorage. Colleen.
Hi. Hey. So Mark earlier said that don't give up. Always keep caring when you have a family member or just even somebody who you love who's been in addiction. And I have a nephew who's been addicted for, since he was a teenager. And for the last several years, I'm pretty sure he uses heroin, and it feels hopeless, from somebody who cares. And, I was saying earlier that when he calls, often I'm reluctant to answer.
Yeah.
I know that's not the right thing to do. I just don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to you, hon.
Yeah.
I'd like you to call me and you and I sit down and chat, and I can give you some tools to work with that will help you feel better, and it will also help your nephew. We can meet and have coffee, and I can just explain to you the not answering the phone is definitely not going to make you or him feel better or improve the situation. So if you could write down my number, 440-7289,
sure.
If you don't write it down, just Google realaboutaddiction.net, because I'd really like to talk with you. I know how it feels to be you. We are the same.
Yeah.
And to have somebody say that to me back when I was lost and hurting as the mother of somebody with heroin addiction, nobody said that to me. And this could have happened years ago if somebody would have said that to me, but it's such a hidden secret.
But I mean, let me ask you this, Kim, you have so many times tried to help your daughter and have seen her almost get there and then fall back. I mean, in terms of Colleen's question, how do we keep hope? How do you keep going? It just seems so hard.
I keep hope because of the phone call I got yesterday from somebody who is now 9 months clean and sober,
mm-hmm.
and has chosen to not live in Anchorage, has chosen to live in Soldotna, has her first job, got her first apartment today.
So it happens, yeah. It
that's
does happen.
Where I get my hope. And I just love her. I love her like a family member. That's where I get my hope.
Yeah. And so I remind people, I've seen Kim grow a lot in the last few years, and here she, I mean, she jumped in and did her homework and networked, and she's just a true advocate champion. And the thing is, I remind people, I didn't get it the first time I went through treatment, and I stumbled a lot along the way.
It took
decades,
didn't it?
And it wasn't, that treatment was a failure, but I mean, I learned some lessons there, and I had to go out and fall down again and learn some new lessons. And so that's just the thing is that, you know, relapse doesn't have to be part of people's journey, but the reality is oftentimes it is. But what we find out is when we network and we show up like we do and invest in these people, that even if they stumble and they go back out, they often, it doesn't take them as long to find their way back. Mm-hmm. You know, if they know that there's somebody that will be there, that will answer that phone, that will help them get plugged in, you know, they don't forget that. They don't. And so, yeah, people, we're human. We make mistakes. But the beauty of it is that, you know, with Kim and her daughter, there's a ton of hope. I've seen a lot of changes in their relationship. Mm-hmm. And I have the utmost hope that we're going to continue to network and partner in that situation. And I just have great faith that we're going to get there. We're getting there.
Colleen, how does that strike you?
Yeah, great. I missed the phone number, but I appreciate the information for sure.
You want to throw that number out one more time, Kim?
440-7289.
Yeah.
All right. Got it. Thank you so much.
And you can.
You're welcome. Looking forward to it.
And listeners, you can network with our guests through our website as well at alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show, Hometown Alaska, Grassroots Response to the Opioid Crisis. And we've got links to Mark Weaver and Kim Whitaker and their organizations. And I'm sure if you're not in need, they could also use help. So that's always good, too. All right. Let's go to Kara, who's calling from Juneau. Kara?
Yo. Hey.
Hey, Kara.
Hello.
Hey, Kara.
Hi, Kara.
Hi.
I just want to shout out to the world. What an incredible, incredible hope and inspiration that these two are and everyone that they're involved with. Everything that you just talked about, talking with Colleen, the prior caller, on just giving that inspiration, because it is hard. Yeah. It is extremely difficult when it feels like there's no hope. And Kim, you hit it right on that there's hope when we see others. Recovery can and does happen. And I just want to say from Juneau, Alaska, and everyone that's listening, there are so many champions across the state.
Yeah.
These two are at the top.
Well, we see ourselves in others, Kara, and you. I just love you, sister, so much, man. I'm hugging you through the airwaves right now. Just
too.
Loving
you. Oh,
dear. Cool.
I want everyone to know that it is a we thing, that we have come together as, I'm someone who's formerly incarcerated and someone who's in long-term recovery and someone that has been at the ground up on a grassroots effort. Running a recovery residence here in Juneau. And it really has taken this much time, but we are here now. And so if you can support our effort, we are doing the work. And if you can't support our efforts, that's okay too. Just please don't stand in our way as we're doing that, because it is incredibly effective to have all of us together in unity, all Alaskans for all Alaskans, and driving this thing. And I have seen change, and it's incredible, and I'm so incredibly grateful for you guys.
Yeah, as am I. And something that struck me is that as volunteers and as grassroots people who are not all tied up with grants and with government restrictions and regulations and all that stuff, you guys are probably more effective than you would be if you were part of the government. And so we tend to turn to government and say, give us a solution, but maybe investing in grassroots volunteerism is really a more valuable way to go. I don't know. I'd love to hear from each of our guests on that, Mark.
Yeah. I mean, some people might think there's some bias in this, but the reality is that, you know, we are doing a lot of work, and we would like to be able to pay people and to train people to do what we do. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But it's being out in the street and not sitting behind a desk in an office somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So, absolutely. But I also just want to encourage, I know, you know, a lot of people, you know, they hear, when we start talking about money, you know, people are like, hey, yeah, send me your money. But the thing is like, we need support all the way around, not just financial. So if you're not in a position to give to your nonprofits, you know, keep us in prayer and spread the word and just, you know, let people know that there are people out there that actually care about, you know, solutions.
Yeah. And it sounds, Kim, like if we're going to spend money, spending money on additional detox beds and long-term recovery facilities would be a really good way to spend it. Do you think that's the biggest need right now?
Exactly. That is the biggest need. Because like I've said, the number one thing is a human connection with somebody to care. So that's what we can do that. but we can't do a detox, and I can't open up a rehab center as quickly as we need it. And the hospitals are already established, so that just seems to me to be the answer. I'm not a professional. I'm just a human, but I see a big building there, and I just know that there's got to be a place in there for a few beds that can handle detox and keep them until we get them into a program. Call us to come in, and there is one hospital that works that's really leaps and bounds ahead of the rest. The Valley is by far. Regional is on board. Sad to say that it's due to a secretary there that has lost a child to addiction. Mark and I know so many people that are now very, very best friends of ours who have lost their children to death. And it's sad why we know them, but we love them dearly. And they speak and they get involved because it makes them feel better and they feel like they're living for their child now.
Yeah, but I mean, the ground floor grassroots folks can only do so much, but you also have to have the medical facilities and all of this stuff brought in, and that's what seems to be taking a long time.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's been, you know, the medical detox portion of it, we've definitely been slacking for forever here.
Yeah.
And we're making a lot of strides in ambulatory detox, using the bridge device and non-narcotic medications. Some people probably heard a little bit about the Lazarus Project. And but anyway, I know we don't have a lot of time to talk about those things, but our ambulatory, we're making you know, great progress there. But yeah, definitely on the medical side, we need more detox options. And again, I just want to put the emphasis on, you know, sober living homes, housing. That's the key. That's the hard part right now.
Well, I want to thank both of my guests for all that they do. I've been so impressed with them since I met them last fall. Just seen the great work they're doing, and so thank you for the entire community. Mark Weaver is Vice President of Fallen Up Ministries. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Charles, for the things that you do.
Oh, well, thanks. And that's Kim Whitaker. She's Real About Addiction, and as I said, you can find links to their organizations on our website, alaskapublic.org. And now I'm just going to take a minute for myself, because I have been with you for 9 years on Hometown Alaska, which seems like a really long time, and I've kind of decided that's probably enough. I'm going to be stepping aside and letting my co-host Kathleen McCoy take over. I've enjoyed doing this show and done so many interesting topics and connecting with listeners and with guests in the studio. And Alaska Public Media is such a terrific organization to be part of. I'm still going to continue to do the Outdoor Explorer show, but for my life and my work life, writing columns for the Anchorage Daily News and writing books and all the other things I do, I just had to take something off the list. And so it's going to be Hometown Alaska. So anyway, this is my swan song, and that's my goodbye from the show. And I want to thank Dave Waldron, a producer of the show, who does a terrific job, and I've really enjoyed working with him. Shelley Wozniak, the program director. Of course, Beattie Trantina, a program director for very many years and working here at the station for 3 decades, and I've known her the whole time. Started talking on these microphones when I was still in high school more than 30 years ago. So I'll always have my heart here at KSK and Alaska Public Media. So that's all for today's show. Kathleen McCoy will be with you next week. Thanks very much. My name is Charles Woolforth, and it's Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.